This is Culturetopia, your weekly dose of culture love from your friends at National Public Radio. I'm Netta Ulaby, reporter for NPR's Arts Desk.
And I'm Linda Holmes, editor for NPR's arts and entertainment blog, Monkey See.
Just a reminder, you can subscribe at npr.org/Culturetopia.
This week, a look at the upcoming sequel to Winnie the Pooh.
And a conversation with former Talking Head David Byrne about his love of the bicicleta and his new book, Bicycle Diaries.
But first,
Drew Barrymore's directorial debut, Whip It, did not do super great at the box office, but it has been killer with one demographic in particular, roller derby fans. The movie follows a character played by young Ellen Page. She becomes a member of an Austin, Texas team called the Hurl Scouts, and that brought real roller derby teams out in force. Zoe Chace caught up with the Mason-Dixon Roller Vixens at a suburban Washington, D.C. movie theater.
Robin Wiegand and Amanda Kerstetter are accosting people in line on their way to see Whip It at the Valley Mill Mall in Hagerstown, Maryland.
Hey guys, do you like chicks in underwear and fishnets? You should come see us.
Sure.
Yeah.
They're passing out flyers, hoping the movie drums up local interest in their team. Amanda's in a tutu. Robin's in rainbow tights. They're explaining roller derby to a group of guys who have never heard of it. They inform the guys that roller derby's all ladies.
Rolling around beating each other up. It's good entertainment.
Players race around a track on roller skates and occasionally knock each other out of the way to get ahead. They dress campy, a ton of makeup and sassy pantyhose, and they use pseudonyms. I can't say Amanda's over the radio, but Robin goes by Switchblady. Sydney Harbaugh goes by Liz Dexic.
Hopefully we get a new audience, because people still, we've been here 2 years and people still don't know that there's derby in Hagerstown.
There's about 20 derby girls here to see the movie tonight. Liz Dexic heads to the box office. She's got a reflective roller skate the size of an apple hanging around her neck.
Can I use a card? Okay. Can I get a ticket for Whip It?
The theater feels like it's chock full of Mason-Dixon Vixens, including Captain Fanny Harmher.
I do feel bad for the other people that just came to watch the movie. We've kind of taken over, and I really don't think they're going to get any peace. Well, they'll see what roller derby's really about.
Not sure if the team is winning any hearts and minds here. Polly G. Gamey's throwing popcorn at Liz Dexter.
No necking!
And even after it starts, Psychosis and Fanny Harmher can't stop themselves from debating the film's accuracy.
Well, you have to boil the mouth guard and fit it around your teeth so you couldn't, like, somebody
that's
couldn't give
true,
you.
That's not true, because Stun Hunt forgot her mouth guard one time and she wore mine.
Oh, that's gross.
By day, Fanny Harmher is Ms. Leatherman, a first grade teacher. Psychosis is Amber Morey, a stay-at-home mom with three kids. But they cheer like a class of eighth graders at the end. They totally love the movie. Really, they love everything that has to do with roller derby. And for Psychosis, it's been transformative.
I was a very shy person, just very, you know, I've been home for 13 years with my kids. I have a 13-year-old son, so I was real sheltered and real at home, and I found this group of girls, and I always had the voice down in me. It just was brought out. And hallelujah for that, because, you know, it's time.
It's time for roller derby to take off in Hagerstown. Psychosis thinks there'll be a Whip It bump at the team's next home bout on November 8th. For NPR News, I'm Zoe Chace.
What a great piece.
It really is, and it's a fantastic movie, I thought. Not that many people saw it, but the people who saw it were very enthusiastic about it in many cases. It's a really unusual movie in the sense that it's a sports movie about a team of women. It really does focus on them and their friendships and the importance of doing something that you really, really love. And it's a rare movie in that regard. And a friend of mine who has a 5-year-old daughter said, I'm going to buy this movie on DVD and put it in her room, and she gets to open it when she's 13. And I think that's the kind of feeling that I think some people may have about it, that if you've got a girl who needs a movie like this, there aren't that many.
Now let's turn to something all 5-year-olds would like. Return to the Hundred Acre Wood is the first authorized sequel to the story of Winnie the Pooh by A.A. Milne. As Lynn Neary reports, it sticks pretty close to the original in both tone and style.
Winnie the Pooh may be the most famous character in A.A. Milne's story, but everyone has their own personal favorite. There's Perky Piglet, Fussy Rabbit, and Gloomy Eeyore. 6-year-old Catherine Crocker's favorite is the hyperactive kangaroo named Roo.
Roo was cute, and he had a friend, Tigger, and
His personality is kind of cute because, well, he hops a lot and squeaks.
The writer who has taken on the task of recreating the Hundred Acre Wood and all its inhabitants is David Benedictus.
With something like Milne, I think everyone knows the stories so well that there was quite a lot of pressure from people who wanted to have their finger in the pie. I had to be very mature and very tolerant, and those are not my usual qualities. I'm a bit of an indiscreet sort of person, so I had to be extremely political. I think I'm ready for the Senate now.
Benedictus says one decision that involved some wrangling was the creation of a new character. Benedictus was determined there should be one, though his first concept was not well received.
I had begun the idea of having a grass snake, but there were those who thought that a grass snake would be too scary for children. So I kept the characteristics of the grass snake, but the new character became Lottie the otter. And she is a bit of a snob, and she's a bit catty too. I wouldn't want to get into a slanging match with Lottie much, but that was important because I did want a new character with a bit of oomph.
The trustees and the publishers didn't want the characters to stray too much from the original, and Benedictus said he did feel an obligation to be faithful to Milne's creation. Author David Benedictus says he expects some negative reaction, especially from those who feel no one should tread upon the sacred woods that Milne made famous.
It's like if you're a conductor and you decide to do a new version of Beethoven's Ninth, and people may not like it, but the score is still there for other people. And so if the worst comes to the worst and everyone thinks I've got it entirely wrong, I won't have destroyed the originals in any way at all.
Does this feel like your book?
Yes, it does. It certainly does after all these years. But I think I share it with Milne, and I couldn't have written it without Milne having set the scene for me and created the characters for me. But yes, I feel like he's a sort of, I don't know, an old uncle sitting in the background, either smiling or frowning at my efforts a little bit.
A.A. Milne wrote 20 Winnie the Pooh stories. Benedictus has now added another 10. Who knows how many more there will be before the tale of Christopher Robin and his friends really, truly comes to an end. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
You can see some material from the new book at our website, npr.org. One story not for children is a new film called Precious. Oprah Winfrey is just one of the African-American luminaries lining up behind the movie, which is both harsh and hauntingly beautiful. Precious is about a teenage girl in Harlem who's obese, illiterate, and horribly abused. It's based on a 1996 best-selling novel called Push, and director Lee Daniels' adaptation has already won major awards at film festivals. Here's Netta with the story.
Lee Daniels is having a moment. Daniels is sprawling on a creamy sofa in a plush suite at the Four Seasons Hotel. His movie, Precious, is about to take the top prize at the Toronto International Film Festival. It's the second film he's ever directed. Then Oprah Winfrey sweeps in.
Gorgeous, gorgeous love.
You've changed again.
Winfrey, resplendent in a purple tunic, has hitched her solid gold media wagon to this tiny but powerful movie.
I had never seen anything like that. It was guttural. It was primal. It felt like, wow, that hit a nerve.
The main character in Precious escapes from her hellish existence through a convoluted fantasy life.
My name is Clarice Precious Jones. I want to be on the cover of a magazine. I wish I had a light-skinned boyfriend with real nice hair. But first, I want to be in one of them BET videos.
These superficial adolescent dreams are more important and complicated than you might expect. They work as her refuge while Precious is being abused.
You're a dummy. Don't nobody want you. Don't nobody need you.
The villain in Precious is the girl's terrifying mother, a mean-eyed creature so slovenly you can practically smell her. She's complicit when Precious is raped by her father, repeatedly. And the mother abuses Precious too, emotionally, physically, and sexually. She denies it to her daughter's social worker.
I don't want you to sit there and judge me, Miss Weiss.
You shut up and you let him abuse your daughter.
I did not want him to abuse my daughter. I did not
but
want him to hurt her.
Him
I did not want
her.
Him to do nothing to her. So those things that she told you I did to her, who else was going to love me? Who was going to make me feel good?
I'm a little nervous about white people seeing the world because I feel like it's a snapshot into something maybe you shouldn't even be into. This is mine. This is my world.
Director Lee Daniels knew families like that one growing up in West Philadelphia.
When I was 11, there was a little girl that came to my home at 3 in the afternoon. We just got out of school. This little girl I grew up with, she was naked. She came to my front door. She said, my mommy beat me and my mom's going to kill me. And I'll never forget the feeling that it had in me.
Daniels discovered that feeling made eloquent when he read the novel Push by Sapphire. He resolved to adapt it as a movie that expressed the book's vivid energy and its explicitly gay characters.
Because in my culture, homosexuality is really looked down on, and I really wanted to surprise people.
The teenage protagonist is not gay, but the teacher who transforms her life is.
This hero, she's a lesbian. And I knew that that would upset a lot of people that were African-American that looked down on lesbianism.
Over the past 20 years, Daniels has slowly climbed up the Hollywood food chain, from production assistant to casting director to producer of Monsters Ball, which scored the first Academy Award for a black leading actress. Still, he was forced to cash in all his chips to raise $3 million to film Precious.
Come on, you know, who wants to finance a movie about a 300-pound black girl?
It takes a certain perseverance, perhaps like Tyler Perry's. If Oprah Winfrey is queen of all media, Perry is its do-it-yourself king. Far off the Hollywood grid, Perry produces, writes, directs, and stars in boisterous lowbrow comedies that have earned more than $400 million worldwide. They include I Can Do Bad All By Myself and Madea's Family Reunion.
It's so good to see the whole family together. Thank you, Madea.
I tried. I used my pistol for some of them because that's all they understood.
But Tyler Perry wants to take his hyper-success making movies for a mostly black female audience in a more serious direction. He says he picked this film as a start because he identified with Precious.
Well, for me, you know, my mother was my protector growing up because I was in a house like the one in Precious.
Perry's mother shielded him from his abusive father's violence. He says that's why now he often tells women's stories.
She would take me everywhere with her to protect me. So I went to hair salons and I went to the Lane Bryant and I would listen to all these women, you know, a little boy listening to all this. I soaked up everything.
Perry signed up as executive producer of Precious after seeing a rough cut of the film. Then he got Winfrey to sign up too. But director Lee Daniels had already cast a number of his famous friends who showed up in Toronto to support the film. Mariah Carey squeezes her way through a crowded Four Seasons hallway. She plays a tough, dowdy social worker in Precious. The movie also features Lenny Kravitz as a nurse and Sherry Shepherd from The View. Mary J. Blige wrote a song for the film. The likable comedian Monique shed her glamorous image to play the gut-wrenching monster of a mother.
Precious, you want to stand up there and look down at me like you're a woman? You don't know what real women do. Real women sacrifice. Now smile about that, you fat.
When Oprah Winfrey saw the movie for the first time, she called Monique immediately. Didn't say hello, just asked one question.
Who's your favorite designer? Get your dress ready, girl. Get your dress ready to walk that red carpet, because that's an Oscar-winning performance if I ever saw one.
But even for Oprah, it's a challenge to market a film with such unsparing themes. Precious comes out in theaters in November. Winfrey wants the film to bridge the art house crowd with the so-called urban audiences that adore Tyler Perry. But Winfrey expects all of them, like her, to leave the theater with new eyes.
How many times have I seen and not seen the Preciouses of the world? How many times have I seen that girl on the street? How many times have I seen her on the corner of Michigan Avenue and Chicago, waiting on a bus? How many times have I seen that girl coming out of Walgreens? How many times have I seen her and not seen her?
Girls like Precious are easy to ignore, says Oprah Winfrey, even to despise. But this movie makes you recognize how perfectly this Precious is named. One thing that I wish I'd expressed in that piece is that it's also really funny. The director, Lee Daniels, brings this very courageous, very fierce sense of humor to this extremely sad story. And one of the things he said in the interview was that, you know, no one wants to watch just 2 hours of sadness. And this humor that he brought, it's a little campy and it's a little dangerous, makes this movie spectacular. It was a very brave directorial decision.
The show August Osage County was the Broadway debut for playwright Tracy Letts, and it was a smash hit. So how do you follow such success? By totally shifting gears. Tracy Letts' new play, Superior Donuts, recently opened on Broadway. Jeff London reports.
His last play was sprawling and dense and long and filled with bitter but enormously entertaining characters. Superior Donuts is a gentle, intimate comedy with serious undertones set in a donut shop in Chicago.
Superior Donuts. Uncle Witt wanted him to call it Shubershevsky Punchki. Dad said Superior was easier to remember and sounds a little like Shubershevsky. And the sign maker's charged by the letter.
I never know where the plays start. I can never sort of trace them back to that original kernel.
But Tracy Letts knew that he wanted to look at a certain kind of man who came of age during the Vietnam era.
They were romantics. And like most romantics, reality did some damage to them. And I was curious about that generation of men and just how they were dealing with that damage now, 40 years later, as that particular class of boomers leaves middle age and enters into their old age. I don't know. Those were the ideas I was interested in exploring. That and I like donuts.
The play takes place in a forlorn donut shop in a slowly gentrifying neighborhood. Actor Michael McKean, well known for his roles in the mockumentaries This Is Spinal Tap, Best in Show, and A Mighty Wind, plays the shop's lonely owner, Arthur Shubershevsky.
This is his cradle, in a sense, and it might be his tomb as well. But it all depends on how much of the outside world he lets in and what he lets that outside world do to him.
And that outside world comes crashing through his front door in the character of Franco Wicks, a 21-year-old African-American applying for a part-time job. Tracy Letts says Franco immediately shakes things up.
It's about that clash between those two guys. Not just because they're of different races, not just because they're of different generations, but because of a different impulse centered very deep in them about hopefulness versus hopelessness.
You're not giving much credit to the discernment of the consumer, African-American or otherwise.
Discernment implies a choice. You don't see no Whole Foods in this neighborhood, do you?
Oh, it's coming. You got a Starbucks right across the street.
Brother, they got Starbucks in wheat fields now. You don't see a lot of brothers in the Starbucks, do you? And you ain't never seen a brother in the Whole Foods unless he's stocking the shelf.
24-year-old actor John Michael Hill is making his Broadway debut as Franco.
He's got strong convictions. He's a challenger. He wants to transform the world into his vision, and he has pretty good ideas about things and how to do that, but a little misguided on where to start.
And he comes from a broken home. Over the course of the play, Arthur becomes something of a surrogate father and mentor to Franco. Playwright Tracy Letts was dealing with father issues of his own while he was writing the play.
Actually, I'd started writing the play while my father was still alive. I completed the play after my father had passed away, so I'm sure those thoughts were activated by my father's illness and his death. The father-son dynamic in both of these guys is it's always a very fraught dynamic, whether it's fulfilled or unfulfilled. And so it does provide a lot of the dramatic impulse for the show.
Superior Donuts opens at the Music Box Theater tonight. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
There's a whole different drama happening on the streets outside of theaters, and according to David Byrne, the best place to watch it is from the seat of a bicycle. He says that bicycle riding is faster than a walk, slower than a train, and slightly higher than a person. Jackie Lydon spoke with the former frontman of the Talking Heads about his new book, Bicycle Diaries.
I started riding around the Lower East Side and Soho and that area in New York at least 25 years ago when I lived there in that part of town. And I didn't venture too much beyond that. I had a little bike that I had from high school and at my parents' house. So I said, oh, I'll bring that. I'll get that. And I can ride to the clubs if I want to hear some music or a bar or an art gallery opening in Soho, or art galleries were in Soho at that point. It was just total convenience. There was not the crowds and traffic in some of those areas that there are now, so it was really easy. I got a little bit of criticism because it was considered very geeky. That was about it.
I'm really glad you came in with your helmet, looking only a bit steamy, because I thought you really are fearless. You just rode here through New York traffic. you become just so bold riding across Istanbul, Manila.
Well, Istanbul has a lot of hills, so you have to avoid the hills. But the traffic is so bad that you can get around much faster on a bike. And I would say probably the same thing is true in a lot of Manila.
So, David Byrne, as you're touring around the world on your bicycle, what makes a great bike ride? Do you have a lot of human connection, or is it impression?
Some rides are just getting from A to B. Not too much happens. And to be honest, yeah, the book is not really about bikes or biking. I guess pedaling around, your conscious mind is occupied to some extent by the act of having to pay attention and pedal. And so your unconscious mind can kind of wander or surface, and sort of ideas and thoughts come to you. And I think that's what it's about. It's about you're seeing things, and then they start to fit together or not. Part of that, I think, is because you're engaged in this other activity that allows those connections to be made that might not seem logical or sensible at first. And then and you go, oh, yeah, look, there is a connection there.
And any tips for bicyclists you want to leave us with?
Well, the pedestrians are rubbing up against the bicycles and the bicycles against the cars, and everybody's kind of figuring out, how do we do this? Everybody has to kind of take the first step and stop at a red light and ride the right way. That's going to take a little time.
You can hear the rest of the interview on our website. Psycho killer.
Thanks for listening to Culturetopia.
You can find links to all the stories we had today and subscribe to the podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I'm Linda Holmes.
And I'm Netta Ulibi. So long.